and along with a handful of other procrastinators, was scrambling to finish by the deadline, so he did not factor into the calculations. "Let's be Charlie's angels," Lexi cried in a burst of inspiration. So she and Serena and Pearl donned bell-bottoms and polyester shirts and teased their hair as high as they could. Hairdos fully inflated, they posed, back to back, fingers pointed like guns, and surveyed themselves in the mirror in a haze of hairspray. "Perfect," Lexi said. "Blonde, brunette, and black." She aimed her finger at Pearl's nose. "You ready for this party, Pearl?" The answer, of course, was no. It was the most surreal night Pearl had ever experienced. All evening, cars driven by skateboarders and animals and Freddy Kruegers pulled up to park at the edges of Stacy's huge lawn. At least four boys wore scream masks, a couple donned football jerseys and helmets, a creative few wore long jackets and fedoras and sunglasses and feather boas. "Pimps," Lexi explained. Most of the girls wore skimpy dresses and hats or animal ears, though one had transformed herself into Princess Leia. Another, dressed as a fembot, hung on the arms of an Austin Powers. Stacy herself was dressed as an angel, in a silvery spaghetti-strapped mini-dress, glittery wings and fishnets, and a halo on a headband. By the time Lexi and Serena and Pearl arrived at 9:30, everyone was already drunk. The air was thick with sweat and the sharp, sour smell of beer, and couples dry-humped in darkened corners. The kitchen floor was sticky with spilled drinks, and some girl was lying flat on her back on the table among the half-empty liquor bottles, smoking a joint and giggling as a boy licked rum from her navel. Lexi and Serena poured themselves drinks and wriggled into the makeshift dance floor in the living room. Pearl, left alone, stood in the corner of the kitchen, nursing a red Solo cup full of Stoli and Coke, and looking for Trip. Half an hour later, she caught a glimpse of him, out on the patio, dressed as a devil in a red blazer from the thrift store and a pair of devil horns. "I didn't think he even knew Stacy," she shouted into Serena's ear when Serena came back to refill her drink. Serena shrugged. "Stacy said she saw him with his shirt off after soccer practice one day and thought he was fine. She said, and I quote, 'He was the bomb diggity.'" She took a swig and giggled. Her face, Pearl noticed, was flushed. "Don't tell Lexi, okay? She barf." She headed back toward the living room, wobbling slightly on her wedge heels. And through the sliding glass door, Pearl watched Trip poke a red-headed girl between the shoulder blades with his plastic pitchfork. She fluffed her hair and made a plan. In a little while, Trip's cup would be empty. He would come inside and he would see her. "What's up, Pearl?" he would say. And then she would say something clever to him. She tried to think of something. What would Lexi say to a boy she liked? But as she racked her brain for something sultry and witty, she noticed that Trip had disappeared from the patio. Had he come inside, or had he left already? She wriggled her way into the living room, cup held aloft, but it was impossible to see anyone. Puff Daddy and Mace poured from the stereo, the bass thumping so loud she could feel it in her throat, then faded back to make way for Notorious B.I.G. The only light came from a few candles, and all she could make out were silhouettes writhing and grinding in decidedly unchaste ways. She wormed her way out into the backyard, where a knot of boys were chugging beer and arguing about the football team's chances of the playoffs. "If we beat Ignatius," one of them shouted, "and U.S. beats Mentor." Lexi, meanwhile, was having a momentous night. She loved dancing. She and Serena and their friends went downtown any time clubs had a teen night, or any time they thought their fake IDs, identifying them as college juniors, would get them past a bouncer. Once they'd snuck into a rave in a disused warehouse down in the flats and danced until 3, glow necklaces ringing their wrists and their throats. They often danced together, with the ease of two girls who had known each other for more than half their lives, hip to hip or pelvis to pelvis, Lexi backing up to twitch her rear against Serena. Tonight they were dancing together when Lexi felt someone press up against her from behind. It was Brian, and Serena gave her a knowing smirk before turning away. "You're not even in costume," Lexi protested, smacking him on the shoulder.
"I am in costume," Brian insisted. "I'm the guy who just mailed his application to Princeton."
He wrapped his arms around her waist and put his mouth to her neck. Half an hour later, the dancing and the liquor and the sweet, heady rush of being 18 had filled them both with a feverish flush. In the time they'd been dating, they'd done some stuff, as Lexi had coyly put it to Serena. But it, the big it, had sat between them for a while, like a deep pool of water in which they only dipped their toes. Now, pressed against Brian, mellowed by rum and coke, music pounding through both their bodies like a shared heartbeat, she was filled with a sudden longing to plunge into that pool and dive straight to the bottom. When she had been younger and less experienced, Lexi had had visions about her first time. She'd planned it out. Candles, flowers, boys to men on the CD player, at the very least a bedroom and a bed. Not the backseat of a car, the way some of her friends had. Definitely not in the stairwell of the high school, as rumor had it Kendra Solomon had. But now she found that she didn't care about that anymore. "Want to go for a drive?" she asked. Both of them knew what she was suggesting. Without speaking, they hurried out to the curb where Lexi's car was waiting. By the time Lexi and Brian had gone, Pearl was back in her corner of the kitchen, waiting for Tripp to reappear. But he didn't. Not by 10:30, not by 11. With each hour that passed and each bottle that emptied, things got louder and looser. At just past midnight, Stacy Perry herself, trying to pour a glass of water, vomited into the Brita pitcher. And Pearl decided it was time to head home. But there was no sign of Lexi, even when she fought her way through the pulsating mass of bodies in the living room. Peeking outside, she couldn't tell whether Lexi's Explorer was still parked in the uneven row of cars. "Have you seen Lexi?" she asked anyone who seemed remotely sober. "Or Serena?" Most people stared at her as if trying to place her.
"Lexi?" they said. "Oh, Lexi Richardson? You came with her?"
At last, one girl, splayed in the lap of a football player in the big armchair, said,
"I think she took off with her boyfriend. Isn't that right, Kev?"
In response, Kev put his meaty hands to her face and pulled her mouth toward his, and Pearl turned away. She wasn't entirely sure where she was, and the vodka blurred the already sketchy map of Shaker in her mind. Could she walk home from here? How long would it take? What street did Stacy even live on? For a minute, Pearl allowed herself to fantasize. Maybe Tripp would come through the sliding glass door, a crisp waft of cool air following him into the kitchen.
"You need a ride home?" he'd say.
But of course this didn't happen. And at last, Pearl snuck the cordless phone from the kitchen counter, ducked outside by the garage where it was quieter, and called Moody. 20 minutes later, a car pulled up in front of Stacy's house. The passenger window rolled down, and from her perch on the front steps, Pearl saw Moody's scowling face.
"Get in," was all he said.
The inside of the car was all buttery leather, soft as skin under her thighs.
"Whose car is this?" she asked stupidly as they pulled away from the curb.
"My mom's," Moody said. "And before you ask, she's asleep, so let's not waste time here."
"But you don't have a license yet."
"Being allowed to do something and knowing how to do it are not the same thing." Moody wheeled the car around the corner and turned onto Shaker Boulevard.
"So how drunk are you?"
"I had one drink. I'm not drunk." Even as she said this, Pearl wasn't sure it was true. There had been a lot of vodka in that cup. Her head spun and she closed her eyes.
"I just didn't know how to get home."
"Tripp's car was still there, you know.
We passed it on the way out.
Why didn't you ask him?"
"I couldn't find him. I couldn't find anyone.
Probably upstairs with some girl." They rode in silence for a while, those words churning in Pearl's mind. upstairs with some girl. She tried to picture it. What happened up in those darkened rooms? Imagined Tripp's body against hers, and a hot flush crept over her. According to the clock on the dashboard, it was nearly 1 o'clock.
"You see now," Moody said, "what they're like?"
As they approached Mia and Pearl's block, he clicked the lights off and pulled up to the curb.
"Your mom is going to be pissed."
"I told her I was going out with Lexi, and she said I could stay out until 12.
I'm only a little late."
Pearl glanced up at the lighted kitchen window.
"Do I stink?"
Moody leaned in close.
"You smell a little like smoke, but not like booze. Here."
He pulled a pack of Trident from his pocket. The Halloween party would, by all accounts, last until 3:15 a.m., and end with a number of kids passed out on the Perry's oriental living room carpet. Lexi would creep home at 2:30, Trip at 3, and the next day they would still be asleep past noon. Later, Lexi would apologize to Pearl in a whispered confession. She and Brian had been thinking about it for a while, and tonight seemed like the night, and she didn't know. She just wanted to tell someone. She hadn't even told Serena yet. Did she look any different?
She would look different, to Pearl.
Thinner, sharper, her hair pulled back in a drooping ponytail, traces of mascara and glitter still streaked at the corners of her eyes. She could see in the faint crease just between Lexi's eyebrows what she would look like 20 years from now. Something like her mother. From then on, it would seem to Pearl that everything Lexi did was tinged with sex. A kind of knowingness in her laugh and her sideways glances. In the casual way she touched everyone, on the shoulder, on the hand, on the knee. It loosened you, she would think. It lightened you.
"And how about you?" Lexi would say at last, squeezing Pearl's arm.
"You found your way home okay? Did you have fun?" And Pearl, with a caution of the recently singed, would simply nod.
"For now." She peeled the wrapper from the gum and put it between her lips, and felt the mint bloom on her tongue.
"Thanks." Despite Pearl's insistence that her mother wouldn't mind, Mia minded her lateness very much. When Pearl finally came upstairs, smelling of smoke and alcohol and something Mia was fairly certain was weed, she had not known what to say.
"Go to bed," she had finally managed. "We'll talk about it in the morning."
Morning had come, Pearl had slept in, and even when she finally emerged near noon, disheveled and sandy-eyed, Mia still hadn't known what to say. "You wanted Pearl to have a more normal life," she reminded herself.
"Well, this is what teens do."
Part of her felt she should be more involved, that she needed to know what Pearl was up to, what Lexi was up to, what all of them were up to. But what was she to do? Tag along to their parties and hockey games? Forbid Pearl to go out at all? She'd ended up saying nothing, and Pearl had consumed a bowl of cereal in silence and returned to bed. Soon, however, an opportunity presented itself. The Tuesday after the Halloween party, Mrs. Richardson stopped by the duplex on Winslow Road.
"To see if you need anything now that you're all settled in," she said.
But Mia watched her gaze roam around the kitchen and into the living room. She was familiar with these visits, despite what Lisa said about limited rights of entry, and she stepped back to let Mrs. Richardson get a better view. After nearly 4 months, there was still little furniture. In the kitchen, 2 mismatched chairs and a gate-like table missing 1 leaf, all salvaged from the curbside. In Pearl's room, the twin bed and a 3-drawer dresser. In Mia's room, still only a mattress on the floor and stacks of clothing in the closet. A row of cushions on the living room floor, draped in a bright flowered tablecloth. But the kitchen linoleum was scrubbed, and the stove and fridge were clean. The carpet was spotless. Mia's mattress bed was made with crisp, striped sheets. Despite the lack of furniture, the apartment did not feel empty.
"May we paint?"
Mia had asked when they moved in. And Mrs. Richardson hesitated before saying,
as long as it's not too dark. She had meant, at the time, no black, no navy, no oxblood, though the next day it had occurred to her that perhaps Mia had meant a mural. She was an artist, after all, and you might end up with Diego Rivera, or you might end up with glorified graffiti. But there were no murals. Each room had been painted a different color. The kitchen a sunny yellow, the living room a deep cantaloupe, the bedrooms a warm peach, and the overall effect was of stepping into a box of sunlight, even on a cloudy day. All over the apartment hung photographs, unframed and tacked up with poster gum, but striking nonetheless. There were studies of shadows against a faded brick wall, photographs of feathers clotting the shoreline of Shaker Lake, experiments Mia was conducting with printing photographs on different surfaces. Vellum, aluminum foil, newspapers. One series stretched across an entire wall, photographs taken week by week of a nearby construction site. At first, there was nothing but a brown hill in front of a brown expanse. Slowly, frame by frame, the mound turned green with weeds, covered in brushy grass and scrub, and eventually a small shrub clinging to its peak. Behind it, a three-story tan house slowly rose, like a great beast climbing out of the earth. Front loaders and trucks flitted in and out of the scene like ghosts caught unawares. In the last photograph, a bulldozer raised the dirt to even the terrain, flattening the landscape like a popped bubble. "My goodness," Mrs. Richardson said. "Are these all yours?" "Sometimes I need to see them up on the wall for a while before I know whether I've got something. Before I know which ones I like." Mia looked around at the photographs, as if they were old friends and she was reminding herself of their faces. Mrs. Richardson peered closely at a photo of a sullen young girl in a cowgirl outfit. Mia had snapped it at a parade they'd passed on the way into Ohio. "You have such a gift for portraiture," she said. "Look at the way you've captured this little girl. You can almost see right down into her soul." Mia said nothing, but nodded in a way Mrs. Richardson decided was modesty. "You should consider taking portraits professionally," Mrs. Richardson suggested. She paused. "Not that you're not a professional already, of course, but in a studio, maybe. Or for weddings and engagements? You'd be very highly sought after." She waved a hand at the photographs on the wall as if they could articulate what she meant. "In fact, perhaps you could take portraits of our family. I'd pay you, of course." "Perhaps," Mia said. "But the thing about portraits is you need to show people the way they want to be seen, and I prefer to show people as I see them. So in the end, I'd probably just frustrate us both." She smiled placidly, and Mrs. Richardson fumbled for a response. "Is any of your work for sale?" she asked. "I have a friend in New York who runs a gallery, and she's sold some of my prints." Mia ran a finger along one photograph, tracing the curve of a rusted bridge. "Well, I'd love to buy one," Mrs. Richardson said. "In fact, I insist. If we don't support our artists, how can they create great work?" "That's very generous of you." Mia's eyes slid toward the window briefly, and Mrs. Richardson felt a twinge of irritation at this lukewarm response to her philanthropy. "Do you sell enough to get by?" she asked. Mia correctly interpreted this as a question about rent and her ability to pay it. "We've always gotten by," she said, "one way or another." "But surely there must be times when photographs don't sell. Through no fault of your own, of course. And how much does a photograph typically sell for?" "We've always gotten by," Mia said again. "I take side jobs when I need to. House cleaning or cooking. Things like that. I'm working part-time at Lucky Palace now, that Chinese restaurant over on Warrensville. I've never had a debt I didn't pay." "Oh, of course I wasn't implying that," Mrs. Richardson protested.
She turned her attention to the largest print, which had been stuck up alone over the mantelpiece. It was a photograph of a woman, back to the camera, in mid-dance. The film caught her in blurred motion. Arms everywhere, stretched high, to her sides, curved to her waist. A tangle of limbs that Mrs. Richardson realized with a shock made her resemble an enormous spider, surrounded by a haze of web. It perturbed and perplexed her, but she could not turn away. "I never thought of making a woman into a spider," she said truthfully. Artists, she reminded herself, didn't think like normal people. And at last, she turned to Mia with curiosity. She had never before met anyone like her. Mrs. Richardson had, her entire existence, lived an orderly and regimented life. She weighed herself once per week, and although her weight did not fluctuate more than the 3 pounds her doctor assured her was normal, she took pains to maintain herself. Each morning, she measured exactly 1/2 cup of Cheerios, the serving size indicated on the box, using the flowered plastic measuring cup she'd gotten from Higby's as a new bride. Each evening, at dinner, she allowed herself 1 glass of wine, red, which the news said was most beneficial for your heart, a faint scratch in the wine glass marking the right level to pour. 3 times weekly, she took an aerobics class, checking her watch throughout to be sure her heart rate had exceeded 120 beats per minute. She had been brought up to follow rules, to believe that the proper functioning of the world depended upon her compliance, and follow them and believe she did. She had had a plan from girlhood on and had followed it scrupulously. High school, college, boyfriend, marriage, job, mortgage, children. A sedan with airbags and automatic seatbelts, a lawnmower and a snowblower, a matching washer and dryer. She had, in short, done everything right, and she had built a good life, the kind of life she wanted, the kind of life everyone wanted. Now, here was this Mia, a completely different kind of woman leading a completely different life, who seemed to make her own rules with no apologies. Like the photograph of the spider dancer. Mrs. Richardson found this perturbing, but strangely compelling. A part of her wanted to study Mia like an anthropologist, to understand why and how she did what she did. Another part of her, though she was only vaguely aware of it at the moment, was uneasy. Wanted to keep an eye on Mia, as you might keep your eye on a dangerous beast. "You keep everything so clean," she said at last, running a finger along the mantelpiece. "I should hire you to come to our house." She laughed, and Mia echoed it politely. But she could see the seed of an idea cracking and sprouting in Mrs. Richardson's mind. "Wouldn't that be perfect?" Mrs. Richardson said. "You could come just for a few hours a day and do a little light housekeeping. I pay you for your time, of course. And then you'd have all the rest of your day to take pictures." Mia began searching for the right, delicate words to uproot this idea, but it was too late. Mrs. Richardson had already latched onto it with vigor. "Now, really, why don't you come and work for us? We had a woman who came to clean and do some dinner prep before, but she went back home to Atlanta in the spring, and I could certainly use the help. You'd be doing me a favor, really." She turned around to face Mia squarely. "In fact, I insist. You must have time for your art." Mia could see there was no point in protesting. That protesting, in fact, would only make things worse and lead to ill will. She had learned that when people were bent on doing something they believed was a good deed, it was usually impossible to dissuade them. She thought with dismay of the Richardsons, of the vast and gleaming Richardson house, of Pearl's face when her mother dared set foot on this precious soil. And then she imagined herself safely installed in the Richardson's kingdom, half obscured in the background, keeping watch over her daughter, reasserting her presence in her daughter's life. "Thank you," she said. "That's so very generous of you to offer. How could I refuse?" And Mrs. Richardson beamed. 7. The arrangements were soon settled. In exchange for $300 a month, Mia would vacuum, dust, and tidy the Richardson house 3 times a week and prepare dinner nightly. It seemed an excellent deal, just a few hours of work per day for the equivalent of their rent. But Pearl was displeased. "Why does she ask you?" she demanded with a groan. And Mia bit her tongue and reminded herself that her daughter was, after all, 15. "Because she's trying to be nice to us," she retorted. And thankfully, Pearl let the subject drop. But inside, she was furious at the thought of Mia invading what she thought of as her space, the Richardson house. Her mother would be just a few yards away in the kitchen, hearing everything, observing everything. The afternoons on the couch, the joking she'd come to feel a part of, even the ridiculous ritual of watching Jerry Springer. Everything would be ruined. Just days before, she'd worked up the courage to swat Tripp's hand when he'd made a joke about her pants. "Why so many pockets?" he'd demanded. "What are you hiding in there?" First he'd patted the pockets at the sides of her knees, then those at her hips. Then, when he'd reached for the ones on her rear, she'd smacked him. And to her smitten delight, he'd said, "Don't be mad. You know I love you." And put his arm around her shoulder. With her mother there, though, she would never dare such a thing, and neither, she suspected, would Tripp. Mr. Richardson, too, found the new arrangements awkward. It was one thing, he thought, to hire a housekeeper. It was another to hire someone they already knew, the mother of one of their children's friends. But Mrs. Richardson, he could see, felt it was a generous gesture, so instead of arguing, he made a point of speaking to Mia on her first morning in the house. "We're very grateful for your help," he told her, as she pulled the bucket of cleaning supplies from under the sink. "It's a huge, huge help to us." Mia smiled and reached for a bottle of Windex and said nothing, and Mr. Richardson cast about for something else to say. "How do you like Shaker?" "It's quite a place." Mia sprayed the counter and swept the sponge across it, corralling crumbs into the sink. "Did you grow up in Shaker, too?"
"No, just Elena," Mr. Richardson shook his head. "I've never even heard of Shaker Heights before I met her."
Their first week at Denison, he had fallen for the ardent young woman collecting signatures around campus to end the draft. By the time they graduated, he had fallen for Shaker Heights as well, the way Elena described it. The first planned community, the most progressive community, the perfect place for young idealists. In his own little hometown, they'd been suspicious of ideas. He'd grown up surrounded by a kind of resigned cynicism, though he'd been sure the world could be better. It was why he'd been so eager to leave, and why he'd been smitten as soon as they'd met. Northwestern had been his first choice. He'd been turned down, had settled for the only school that let him leave the state. But once he'd met Elena, it had seemed, to him, like fate intervening. Elena was determined to return to her hometown after school, and the more she told him about it, the more willing he was. It seemed only natural to him that such a place would have formed his principled fiancée, who always strove for perfection, and he gladly followed her back to Shaker Heights after graduation. Now, almost 2 decades later, well settled in their careers and their family and their lives, as he filled up his BMW with premium gas, or cleaned his golf clubs, or signed a permission form for his children to go skiing, those college days seemed fuzzy and distant as old Polaroids. Elena, too, had mellowed. Of course, she still donated to charity and voted Democrat, but so many years of comfortable suburban living had changed both of them. Neither of them had ever been radical, even at a time of protests, sit-ins, marches, riots. But now they owned 2 houses, 4 cars, a small boat they docked at the marina downtown. They had someone to plow the snow in the winter and mow the lawn in the summer. And of course they'd had a housekeeper for years, a long string of them. And now here was the newest, this young woman in his kitchen, waiting for him to leave so she could clean his house. He recollected himself, smiled bashfully, picked up his briefcase. At the doorway to the garage, he paused. "If working here ever stops suiting your needs, please let me know. There will be no hard feelings, I promise." Mia soon settled into a schedule. She arrived in the morning at 8:30, soon after everyone had gone off to work or school, and would be finished by 10. Then she would go home to her camera, returning at 5 o'clock to cook.
"There's no need to make 2 trips," Mrs. Richardson had pointed out. But Mia had insisted midday was the best time for her photography. The truth was that she wanted to study the Richardsons both when they were there and when they weren't. Every day, it seemed, Pearl absorbed something new from the Richardson family, a turn of phrase. "I was literally dying." A gesture, a flick of the hair, an eye roll.
She was a teen, Mia told herself over and over. She was trying on new skins, like all teenagers did. But privately, she stayed wary of the changes she saw. Now, every afternoon, she would be there to check on Pearl, to observe these Richardsons who fascinated her daughter so. Every morning, she would be free to investigate on her own. In the course of her cleaning, Mia began to observe carefully. She knew when Tripp had failed a math test by the shredded scraps in his trash bin, when Moody had been writing songs by the crumpled wads of paper in his. She knew that no one in the Richardson family ate the crust of the pizza or brown-spotted bananas, that Lexi had a weakness for gossip magazines and, based on her bookshelf, Charles Dickens, that Mr. Richardson liked to eat those cream-filled caramel bullseyes by the bagful while he worked in his study at night. By the time she finished an hour and a half later, the house tidy, she had a very good sense of what each member of the family was doing. This was how, a week into her new duties, Mia came to be in the Richardson kitchen when Izzy wandered downstairs at 9:30 in the morning. The day before, Izzy had startled but not surprised her family by being suspended from school. In the middle of orchestra, she had, according to the freshman vice principal, broken the teacher's bow over her knee and thrown the pieces in the teacher's face. Despite repeated questionings and stern talking to's both at school and at home, she had refused to say anything about what had caused this outburst. It was, as Lexi put it, vintage Izzy. Freak out for no reason, do something crazy, learn nothing from it. Consequently, after a hasty meeting with her mother, the principal, and the aggrieved orchestra teacher, she had been suspended from school for 3 days. Mia was cleaning the stove when Izzy stomped in, somehow clomping in bare feet as loudly as she did in her Doc Martens, and stopped. "Oh," she said. "It's you, the indentured servant. I mean, the tenant-slash-cleaning lady." Mia had heard a third-hand version of events from Pearl the day before. "I'm Mia," she said. "I'm guessing you're Izzy?" Izzy settled herself onto a bar stool.
"The crazy one."
Mia wiped the counter carefully. "No one said anything like that to me." She rinsed the sponge and set it in its holder to dry. Izzy lapsed into silence and Mia began to scour the sink. When she had finished, she turned on the boiler. Then she took a piece of bread from the loaf in the bread box, spread it with butter and sprinkled it thickly with sugar, and set it in the oven until the sugar had melted to a bubbling, golden caramel. She set another piece of bread on top, cut the sandwich in two, and set it in front of Izzy. A suggestion, not a command. It was something she did sometimes for Pearl when she was having what Mia called a low day. Izzy, who had been watching silently but with interest, said nothing, but pulled the plate toward her. In her experience, when someone tried to do something for her, it came from either pity or distrust. But this simple gesture felt like what it was. A small kindness, with no strings attached. When she had finished the last bite of sandwich, she licked butter from her fingers and looked up.
"So you want to hear what happened?"
she asked. And the whole story emerged. The orchestra teacher, Mrs. Peters, was widely disliked by everyone. She was a tall, painfully thin woman with hair dyed an unnatural flaxen and cropped in a manner reminiscent of Dorothy Hamill. According to Izzy, she was useless as a conductor, and everyone knew to just watch Carrie Schulman, the first chair violin for the tempo. A persistent rumor, after some years calcified as fact, insisted that Mrs. Peters had a drinking problem. Izzy hadn't entirely believed it until Mrs. Peters had borrowed her violin one morning to demonstrate a bowing. When she'd handed it back, the chin rest damp with sweat, it had smelled unmistakably of whiskey. When she brought her big camping thermos of coffee, people said you knew Mrs. Peters had been on a bender the night before. Moreover, she was often bitingly sarcastic, especially to the second violins, especially the ones who, as one of the cellos put it dryly, were pigmentally blessed. Stories about her had filtered down to Izzy even in middle school. Izzy, who had been playing violin since she was 4 and had been assigned second chair even though she was a freshman, should have had nothing to fear. "You'll be fine," the cello had told her, eyeing Izzy's frizzy golden hair. The dandelion fro, Lexi liked to call it. Had Izzy kept her head down, Mrs. Peters would likely have ignored her. But Izzy was not the type to keep her head down. The morning of her suspension, Izzy had been in her seat, practicing a tricky fingering on the E string for the Saint-Saëns piece she'd been working on in her private lessons. Around her, the hum of violas and cellos tuning up grew quiet as Mrs. Peters stormed in, thermos in hand. It was clear from the start that she was in an extraordinarily foul mood. She snapped at Shanita Grimes to spit out her gum. She barked at Jessie Leibovitz, who had just broken her A string and was fishing in her case for a replacement.
"Hangover,"
Carrie Schulman mouthed to Izzy, who nodded gravely. She had only a general sense of what this meant. A few times Tripp had come home from hockey parties and had seemed, she thought, extra dense and groggy in the morning, even for Tripp. But she knew it involved headaches and ill temper. She tapped the tip of her bow against her boots. At the podium, Mrs. Peters took a long swig from her mug of coffee. "Offenbach," she barked, raising her right hand. Around the room, students rifled through their sheet music. 12 bars into Orpheus, Mrs. Peters waved her arms. "Someone's off!" She pointed her bow at Deja Johnson, who was at the back of the second violins. "Deja, play from measure 6. Deja, who everyone knew was painfully shy, glanced up with the look of a frightened rabbit. She began to play, and everyone could hear the slight tremor from her shaking hand. Mrs. Peters shook her head and wrapped her bow on her stand. "Wrong bowing! Down, up, up, down, up. Again." Deja stumbled through the piece again. The room simmered with resentment, but no one said anything. Mrs. Peters took a long slurp of coffee. "Stand up, Deja. Nice and loud now, so everyone can hear what they're not supposed to be doing." The edges of Deja's mouth wobbled, as if she were going to cry, but she set her bow to string and began once more. Mrs. Peters shook her head again, her voice shrill over the single violin. "Deja, down, up, up, down, up. Did you not understand me? You need me to speak in Ebonics?" It was at this point that Izzy had jumped from her seat and grabbed Mrs. Peters' bow. She could not say, even when telling Mia the story, why she had reacted so strongly. It was partly that Deja Johnson always had the anxious face of someone expecting the worst. Everyone knew that her mother was an RN. In fact, she worked with Serena Wong's mother down at the Cleveland Clinic, and her father managed a warehouse on the west side. There weren't many black kids in the orchestra, though, and when her parents showed up for concerts, they sat in the last row by themselves. They never chit-chatted with the other parents about skiing or remodeling or plans for spring break. They had lived all of Deja's life in a comfortable little house at the south end of Shaker, and she had gone from kindergarten all the way up to high school without, as people joked, saying more than 10 words a year. But unlike many of the other violinists, who resented Izzy for making second chair her first year, Deja never joined in the snide comments, or called her the freshman. In the first week of school, Deja, as they filed out of the orchestra room, had leaned over to zip an unfastened pocket on Izzy's book bag, concealing her exposed gym clothes. A few weeks later, Izzy had been digging through her bag, desperately looking for a tampon, when Deja had discreetly leaned across the aisle and extended a folded hand. Here, she'd said. And Izzy had known what it was before she even felt the crinkle of the plastic wrapper in her palm. Watching Mrs. Peters pick on Deja in front of everyone had been like watching someone drag a kitten into the street and club it with a brick. And something inside Izzy had snapped. Before she knew it, she had cracked Mrs. Peters' bow over her knee and flung the broken pieces at her. There had been a sudden squawk from Mrs. Peters as the jagged halves of the bow, still joined by the horsehair, had whipped across her face, and a shrill squeal as the mug of steaming coffee in her hand tipped down her front. The practice room had erupted in a babble of laughter and shrieking and hooting, and Mrs. Peters, coffee dripping down the tendons of her neck, had grabbed Izzy by the elbow and dragged her from the room. In the principal's office, waiting for her mother to arrive, Izzy had wondered if Deja had been pleased or embarrassed, and she wished she'd had a chance to see Deja's face. Although Izzy was sure now that Mia would understand all of this, she did not know how to put everything she felt into words. She said only, "Mrs. Peters is a total bitch. She had no right to say that to Deja." "Well," said Mia, "what are you going to do about it?" It was not a question Izzy had been asked before. Until now, her life had been one of mute, futile fury. In the first week of school, after reading T.S. Eliot, she had tacked up signs on all the bulletin boards. "I have measured out my life with coffee spoons, and do I dare to eat a peach? And do I dare disturb the universe?" The poem made her think of her mother, doling out her creamer in a precise teaspoon, flipping out about pesticides if Izzy bit into an apple without washing it, rigidly drawing restrictions around her every move, and made her think of her older siblings, too, of Lexi and Tripp and everyone like them, which to Izzy felt like everyone. So concerned about wearing the right things, saying the right things, being friends with the right people. She had fantasies of students whispering in the halls. "Those signs? Who put them up? What do they mean?" Noticing them, thinking about them, waking up, for God's sake. But in the rush before first period, everyone funneled past them up and down the stairwells, too busy passing notes and cramming for quizzes to even glance up at the bulletin boards. And after second period, she found that some dour security guard had torn the signs down, no doubt perplexed by these missives, leaving only flyers for Youth Ending Hunger, Model UN, and French Club. The second week of school, when Ms. Bellamy had asked them to memorize a poem and recite it in front of the class, Izzy had selected This Be the Verse, a poem she felt, based on her 14 and a half years, summed up life quite accurately. She got no further than, "They fuck you up, your mum and dad," before Ms. Bellamy had peremptorily told her to sit down and given her a zero. What was she going to do about it? The very idea that she could do something stunned her. At that moment, Lexi's car pulled into the driveway and Lexi came in, book bag slung over one shoulder, smelling of cigarette smoke and CK1. "Thank God, there it is," she said, plucking her wallet off the edge of the counter. Lexi, Mrs. Richardson liked to say, would leave her head at home if it weren't attached. "Having fun on your vacation day?" she said to Izzy, and Mia saw a light in Izzy switch off. "Thanks for the sandwich," she said, and slid down from her stool and went upstairs. "Jesus," Lexi said, rolling her eyes. "I will never understand that girl." She looked at Mia, waiting for a sympathetic nod, but it didn't come. "Drive carefully," was all Mia said, and Lexi bounced out, wallet in hand, and in a moment, her Explorer revved outside. Izzy had the heart of a radical, but she had the experience of a 14-year-old living in the suburban Midwest, which was to say, she cast about for ideas for exacting revenge, egged windows, flaming bags of dog shit, and chose the best thing in her limited repertoire. 3 afternoons later, Pearl and Moody were in the living room watching Ricky Lake when they saw Izzy stride calmly down the hallway, a six-pack of toilet paper under each arm. They exchanged a single, hasty glance, and then, without discussion, chased after her. You are a freaking idiot,
Moody said when they had intercepted Izzy in the foyer and safely barricaded her in the kitchen. Over the years, he had saved Izzy from her own stupidity, as he thought of it, a number of times. But this, for him, was a new record.
TPing her house?
It's a bitch to clean up, Izzy said. It'll piss her off, and she deserves to be pissed off.
And she'll know it was you, the girl she just suspended.
Moody kicked the toilet paper under the table. If you don't get caught in the act, which you probably would have. Izzy scowled. You have a better idea? You can't just target Mrs. Peters, Mia said. All three children looked up in astonishment. They had forgotten, for a moment, that Mia was there. Yet there she was, chopping a pepper for dinner and sounding like no parent they'd ever encountered. Pearl flushed and shot a glance at her mother. What was she thinking, butting in like this? Let alone butting into this conversation, of all things. What Mia was thinking about, however, was her own teenage years. Memories she'd packed away long ago for safekeeping, but now unfolded and dusted clean. Someone I knew once glued the lock on the history teacher's door, she said. He'd been late, and she'd given him detention, and he'd missed playing in a big football game. The next day, he squirted a whole tube of crazy glue into the lock. They had to break down the door. A faraway smile crept over her mouth. But he only did hers, so they knew it was him right away. He got grounded for a month.
Mom! Pearl's entire face was aflame. Thanks. We've got this.
Hastily, she nudged Izzy and Moody out of the kitchen and out of Mia's earshot. Now they would think her mother was a total nutcase, she thought, unable to even look at them. Had she glanced at their faces, though, she would have seen not derision, but admiration. From the gleam in Mia's eye, both Moody and Izzy could see she was far savvier and far more interesting than they'd imagined. It was their first clue, they would realize later, that there was another side to her. All evening, Izzy turned over Mia's story, her question from before. What are you going to do about it? In those words, she heard a permission to do what she'd always been told not to, to take matters into her own hands, to make trouble. By this point, Izzy's anger had ballooned to cover not only Mrs. Peters, but the principal who'd hired her, the vice principal who had handed out the suspension, every teacher, every adult who'd ever cudgeled a student with arbitrary, unearned power. The next day, she cornered Moody and Pearl and outlined her plan. It's going to piss her off, said Izzy. It's going to piss everyone off. You're going to get in trouble, Moody protested. But Izzy shook her head. I'm doing this, she said. I'm only going to get in trouble if you don't help me. A toothpick, inserted into a standard keyhole and snapped off flush, is a marvelous thing. It causes no damage to the lock, yet it prevents the key from entering so the door cannot be opened. It is not easily removed without a pair of needle-nose tweezers, which are often not handy and take some time to procure. The more impatient the key wielder, the more firmly and insistently the key is jammed into the keyhole, the more tenaciously the toothpick will cling to the innards of the lock, and the longer it will take to extract it, even with the right equipment. A reasonably adept teenager, working quickly, can insert a toothpick into a lock, snap it off, and walk away in approximately 3 seconds. Three teenagers, working in unison, can therefore immobilize an entire high school containing 126 doors in less than 10 minutes, quickly enough to avoid notice and settle into their usual spots in the hallway to watch what ensues. By the time the first teachers noticed their doors were jammed, it was already 7:27. By 7:40, when most of the teachers arrived at their classrooms and found themselves stymied, Mr. Wrigley, the custodian, was upstairs in the science wing attempting to pry the first sliver of toothpick out of the chemistry lab's lock with the tip of his penknife. By 7:45, when Mr. Wrigley returned to his office in search of his toolbox and the tweezers inside it,
he found a large crowd of teachers clustered in his doorway, clamoring about the jammed locks. In the confusion, someone dislodged the doorstop that had been holding Mr. Wrigley's door open and let it slam shut, and Mr. Wrigley finally discovered the toothpick that Izzy herself had carefully placed in his keyhole much earlier when he had stepped out for a mug of coffee. All this time, students had been trickling in. First, the early birds, who came at 7:15 to secure a parking spot on the oval that surrounded the school. Then the students who got dropped off by parents or walked. By the time the late arrivals straggled in at 7:52 and the bell for first period was ringing, the hallways were crammed with gleeful students, bewildered secretaries, and furious teachers. It would be another 20 minutes before Mr. Wrigley returned from his truck, having rummaged in the toolbox in the trunk and finally, to his immense relief, found a second pair of tweezers. It would be another 10 minutes after that when he managed to extract the first toothpick from the first classroom door and the chemistry teacher could at last get to his desk. Morning announcements were postponed, replaced by stern instructions over the PA system that all students were to line up outside their first period classes, which no one heard. The atmosphere in every hallway was like that of a surprise party, with no host in evidence, but everyone somehow as a surprised and delighted guest. From a locker, someone produced a boombox, complete with batteries. Andre Williams, the kicker of the football team, extended the antenna, hoisted it onto his shoulder, and clicked the dial to WMMS, Buzzard Radio, and an impromptu dance party to the Mighty Mighty Bosstones erupted before Mrs. Allerton, the U.S. history teacher, reached him and told him to shut it off. Mr. Wrigley continued to work his way down the hallway, one door at a time, prying splinters of wood from the Yale locks and gathering them in his calloused palm. Down in the arts wing, Mrs. Peters, nursing her extra-large thermos and a splitting headache, began to fidget. The orchestra room was far from the science wing, where Mr. Wrigley was slowly progressing. At this rate, hers would be one of the last, if not the last, door to be unjammed. She had asked Mr. Wrigley several times if he couldn't go faster, if he couldn't take a moment and open her door first, and by the third time, he turned to her, brandishing a scrap of wood in his upturned tweezers. "I'm going as fast as I can, Mrs. Peters," he said. "Going as fast as I can. Everybody's got to wait their turn." He turned back to the keyhole before him, where Mr. DeSanti, the ninth-grade math teacher, had tried to force his key into the lock and splintered the toothpick deep into the cylinders. "Everybody got to be first," he muttered loud enough to be sure Mrs. Peters would hear. "Everybody gotta be important. Well, the man with the tweezers says everybody gotta wait their turn." He thrust the tweezers into the lock again, and Mrs. Peters turned away. That had been an hour and a half ago, and she suspected, accurately, that Mr. Wrigley was holding her room for last to punish her. Fine, she thought, but couldn't he at least open up the faculty lounge? She had checked 3 times now, and the door was still locked. With every minute that passed, she became more aware of the full thermos of coffee, almost an entire potful, she'd emptied while waiting. The girls' bathrooms had swinging doors, unlockable. Surely she would not have to go in there with the students, she thought. Surely he would open the faculty lounge soon, and she could use the unisex restroom there, the one reserved for teachers. As each minute ticked by, her impatience with Mr. Wrigley grew and spread to the principal, to the entire world. Couldn't anyone think ahead? Couldn't anyone prioritize? Couldn't anyone take basic human needs into account? She gave up her post by the orchestra room and took up a new waiting spot outside the faculty lounge, her handbag clutched across her abdomen like a shield. 5 cups of coffee trickled their slow way through her innards. For a few moments, she considered simply getting into her car and driving away. She could be home in 25 minutes. But the longer she stood, the longer 25 minutes seemed, and the more certain it seemed to her that sitting, in any context, would bring disaster. "Dr. Schwab," she said as the principal walked by, "can't you ask Mr. Wrigley to open the faculty lounge, please?" Dr. Schwab had had a difficult morning. It was 9:40, and half of the classrooms were still locked, although he'd asked teachers to bring their students into the classrooms and keep them there until all the doors had been opened. 800 students were still loose in the hallways. Some of them had spilled out onto the steps. Groups of them had formed circles on the lawn, laughing and kicking hacky sacks, and in some cases, even smoking right there on school property. He rubbed his temple with one knuckle. Beneath his collar, his neck began to chafe, and he wiggled a finger beneath his tie. "Helen," he said with as much patience as he could muster, "Mr. Wrigley is going as fast as he can. In the meantime, the girls' bathroom is right down the hall. I'm sure you can use it just this one time." He headed off, doing quick mental calculations. If everyone was back in the classrooms by 10:30, which seemed optimistic, they could run an abbreviated schedule with each period running 34 minutes instead of 50. Mrs. Peters waited another 15 minutes and then could wait no more. She squeezed the handles of her purse tighter, as if that would somehow help, and trotted down the hallway to the girls' bathroom. It was the main restroom, positioned right where the main hallway met the main staircase, and even on a normal day, it was crowded. Today, it was mobbed. A group of boys stood in a ring outside, smashing the apples from their lunches against their foreheads and egging each other on with guttural roars. A group of girls clustered around the water fountain, half of them pretending not to notice the boys, the other half of them flirting with the boys outright. Above them, a mural of a shark looked down with a gaping mouth. Mrs. Peters felt a brief pang of irritation at their youth, their frivolity, their ease. On a normal day, she would have told them to move along or demanded hall passes from each one, but today she was in no condition to care. She elbowed her way through the crowd. "Excuse me, excuse me. Boys, girls, the teacher needs to get through." Inside, the bathroom was crammed with girls. Girls gossiping, girls fixing their hair, girls primping. Mrs. Peters nudged her way past with increasing urgency. "Excuse me, girls. Excuse me, girls." Every girl in the bathroom looked up, wide-eyed, at the intrusion. "Hi, Mrs. Peters," said Lexi. "I didn't know teachers ever used this bathroom." "The faculty lounge is still locked," Mrs. Peters said in what she hoped was a dignified tone. Around her, she noticed that all the girls had gone silent. In ordinary circumstances, she would have approved of the sign of respect, but today she would have preferred to be ignored. She turned and headed for the father's stall, by the window, but when she reached it, she found that it had no door. "What happened to the door?" she asked stupidly. "It's been broken forever," Lexi said, "since the first week of school. They really ought to fix it. You come in here and there's only 3 stalls you can use and you end up being late for class." Mrs. Peters didn't bother to listen to the rest of Lexi's speech. She yanked the door of the next stall open and slammed it behind her. With trembling hands, she slid the latch into place and fumbled with her skirt. But at the sight of the white porcelain bowl, her body, which had been waiting for nearly 2.5 hours, could resist no longer. With a tremendous gush, her bladder gave way, and Mrs. Peters felt a warm rush flood down her legs, and a spreading puddle snaked its way across the tiles and out of the stall. From behind the flimsy partition, Mrs. Peters heard someone say, "Oh, my God." Then a shocked, utter silence. She held completely still, as if, she thought irrationally, the girls outside might simply forget about her. The silence seemed to stretch itself out like taffy. The damp patch on her skirt and her soaked pantyhose turned chilly. And then the giggling began. The kind of giggles that grew all the more obvious for being stifled. Bags were quickly zipped. Footsteps scurried into the hallway. Mrs. Peters heard the door swing open, then shut, and a few moments later she heard roars of laughter from the hallway. She stayed in the stall a long time, until she heard Dr. Schwab on the PA system informing everyone that all doors were now unlocked and all students should be in class or risk detention. When she came out into the bathroom again, it was empty, and she left concealing her stained skirt with her pocketbook, refusing to look at the puddle, which was